39 days until the Vancouver municipal elections. This is the Camby Report. I'm Matthew Naylor.
I'm Patrick Meehan.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. We'd like to acknowledge that we are on the traditional and unceded territories of the Squamish, Musqueam, and Tsleil-Waututh Coast Salish peoples, and we recognize that we are privileged to be here today.
Thank you so much for joining us for our live show. It is like the fourth one of these that we're doing, and I am continuously amazed by the quality and quantity of people who are coming out to these. Thank you so much. It is, like, just incredible.
And people have come to more than one, which means they came to one and went, that didn't suck. We will come back. So thank you for coming back.
Joining us tonight is a friend of the pod and previous guest, Jen St. Denis, reporter for the Star Metro Vancouver. Jen, welcome.
Thanks for having me again.
We've got one more piece of housekeeping news, and that is that we've now launched our blog. Our new website that Ian wonderfully built the other day also contains the ability for us to actually write down our thoughts. So if you don't have enough time to listen to it, you can jump on and give a read.
Patrick's already posted a blog up there, which one commenter basically read as advocating for rent control, which, as anyone who takes Economics 101 should know, Patrick, is bad.
My absolute favorite comment by any dude bro on the internet is, Politics 101 tells you that this is a fact. The fact is, Politics 101 tells you that outside of environmental impacts, this will be true. I thought that would be fun.
I don't know. Facts aren't facts anymore, apparently. This is the crazy world in which we live.
So tonight's show, we have some news to talk about, apparently. Thankfully, we have a real journalist who does real work on these issues and can help us understand how to make sense of news as it comes fast and furious. Then we're going to give, as always, our chance for candidates to come up and give their one-minute spiels, their showcase.
Precisely just, 1 minute.
Just by show of hands, how many candidates for any office, ideally this October 20th, are in the House today? See, one. That's fine. We'll hear from Sarah Blythe. Oh, two, sorry.
Perfect.
And finally, after that, we'll bring up Jens von Bergman to talk about data and Airbnb.
Yeah, so it's been, okay, once again, a week of news. I think the weirdest election in Vancouver's history, Vancouver's modern history, is continuing to be utterly bizarre. Jen, you report on news in Vancouver, right?
So yes, I report on Vancouver. I usually concentrate on housing in City Hall, but I'm trying to make sure to cover it all. We're actually trying to cover Metro, which is really hard, but we're trying.
So we have found.
So one of the things that we've discovered is, I think about 6 or 7 press releases come out from various political parties in the city of Vancouver alone per day.
That's right. And then when you factor in the Metro Vancouver municipalities, it is a flood of press releases right now. And there are a ton of candidates, and they're all formulating their policy platforms right now. So the challenge is how to cover that. And different news orgs are doing different things. Like the Georgia Strait, I feel like, covers every single announcement. They just write something. My approach is to kind of gather them all together in analysis pieces. So however you want to take your news, I think there's something for you. But it does feel like a deluge. I think that the day after, on September 5th, I think people thought, oh, the kids are back at school. I'm going to send my press release that day. Every single person sent their press release that day. So that was a challenge.
Yeah, we're facing the same problem is, you know, how do we cover all of this news? How do we cover, you know, all 7 new Shauna Sylvester platform points in the last 24 hours, while also dealing with the fact that Ian Campbell dropped out of the race? Honestly, it is really cool that Shauna Sylvester is dropping 7 platform pieces. It's just also very hard to read all 7 of them and then be ready to go with the other platform pieces that are coming out.
Yeah, and it's hard to communicate it to the voter who you know is not necessarily always paying attention. You think, how do I not overwhelm readers? How do I try to keep them engaged? You know, municipal elections have a low voter turnout, first of all, and now we have a huge number of candidates in this one election, and so it's really hard. You have to balance different things.
So how would you recommend people, like, individually parse through this kind of thing? Like, do you...
Is there a podcast you'd recommend?
What I like about your live event is that, you know, you're, like, bringing it to the people. You're like, let's get excited about Vancouver, about municipal politics, and I think that's great. Personally, we're trying to do this big, huge kind of explainer piece that we're going to have on our page where people can just go and it'll be a one-stop shop. And they'll be able to kind of just click on their candidate and just see what they're doing, like a really short thing that sort of is like the main points. We're trying to just make it easy for people to get the information that we think that they're looking for. And we're kind of, you know, we have a sense of what people are looking for.
Yeah, people have asked me after I put up the candidate spreadsheet of all the Metro Vancouver, oh, will you expand that to include promises or platform positions and other things? And I'm like, I'm busy. And that's a lot of stuff, especially if I want to do it in an unbiased way, which I think the candidate spreadsheet has been so far. And that's what's strong about it. It's just literally, if you said, I want to run for this, like Vancouver's famous roller girl has said multiple times, she's still running for mayor. She's on the list. But
yeah, I saw her at City Hall the other day. She was putting her nomination papers in.
Oh, she did put them in. That's interesting.
That's a scoop. But like, it's also really hard for us to figure out what, you know, what's the campaign promise, right? Like, Justin Trudeau said that 2015 would be the last election ever fought under first past the post. That was very clear, very precise. We knew what that meant. I mean, it doesn't mean
did
that
now.
Did
we know what that meant? I don't think that was what it meant.
Well, I mean, it doesn't mean that now, but we can say that that was a broken promise. But when a candidate says they're going to fix housing or whatever, I don't mean to, like, I'm not trying to call out one candidate, but when a candidate tries, says they're going to fix housing or whatever, what does that even mean?
Houses must be repaired during his term by the city. Like, this
various renovations will occur.
Although, let us be clear, it is not the candidate saying that he is going to fix housing. It is a third party, which happens to have endorsed the candidate.
I'm pretty sure he says it on his website, too, but we're getting off track.
So, to move from issues of voter in the front of voters' minds to issues of who's going to be on the ballot, it turns out there's one less on the ballot as of last night.
Yeah, this was a big shocker. I was hanging out at the UBCM, the Union of BC Municipalities Convention. Woo, always a fun time at Whistler. And yeah, it was the end of the day. We were actually getting ready to unwind. We were going to have some drinks and some dinner. And then all of a sudden, oh my gosh, Ian Campbell has suddenly resigned, and in a very odd way, with kind of an indication that there is much more to this story. He cited his own complicated personal journey. And if you do a close reading of his statement, as I did, he also combines that phrase with the political landscape. And so I think putting those two together, there's definitely a story there. And you'll probably be hearing more about it in the coming weeks.
So Mario Canseco released a poll today or yesterday that didn't include Ian Campbell, because as soon as he saw Ian Campbell wasn't running, there was no point to wait those tables and release that data. But prior to that, Ian Campbell had always been in a decent position. He wasn't in the top three, but he was sort of...
He was essentially there. Like, if you account for margin of error, he was basically in the top three.
And so there was some suspicion, oh, his poll numbers were bad, or maybe he had bad internal numbers that suggested he had no shot. But he had a better shot, honestly, than many other people in the race right now.
I think there is a legitimate case to make that Ian Campbell was probably the second place candidate, like, up until the moment that he dropped out.
After Kennedy Stewart?
After Kennedy Stewart, yeah. Who has been polling ever since a poll got him into the race, prodded him there, as the first place candidate.
So he had a poll, and that's the interesting thing for me, is that he had a poll, he had voter support, and now that's going to be somewhere else. Thank you. And now that's going to be somewhere else, and so where does that vote go?
Well, apparently, according to Main Street, it involves a lot of undecided people. And this is, like, remarkable, and Mario touched on this last time that we had a live show. It is remarkable that there are so many people who have not made up their minds yet.
But where do those that were going to vote for Ian Campbell go?
Well, we'll have to see that. But I think the point about the undecideds, I mean, I'm finding this in my own social circle. People are coming up to me and saying, who should I vote for? Of course, I can't tell them who to vote for. I don't do that. That would be unprofessional. And they also ask me who I'm voting for, and I have no idea. And I wouldn't tell them even if I knew, but I have no idea. So I think there's this thing out there. There's just almost people are looking at this array of choices. They're trying to find a place to put their vote. And it's really hard for people. And, you know, as sudden as the Ian Campbell resignation was, in some ways, this kind of helps the voter in a way. I think they're kind of makes their decision easier. And I sense that Kennedy Stewart will pick up a lot of that undecided vote.
And I can definitely see that. One of the things Kennedy Stewart dropped recently was that his housing plan includes the tripling the empty homes tax, which
is so familiar.
Yeah,
almost
Campbell
like
talked about
Ian
Campbell promised the same thing.
And of course, Kennedy Stewart talked about a number of other things, and a lot of Vision voters are traditional NDP voters who Kennedy has told us. When we eventually release our Kennedy Stewart interview, both for patrons and the public,
which are available on patreon.com/CambyReport.
So when it comes to that, though, I actually don't know that Sean or that Kennedy Stewart picks up that much of the Ian Campbell vote, because I actually think that a lot of the Vision support that would normally that is normally parked with Vision that are New Democrats would have already moved over to Ian Campbell. Kennedy Stewart. Essentially, Kennedy Stewart is the NDP candidate. Vision Vancouver is sort of an amalgam of NDP and federal liberals. Those New Democrats likely already moved over. And the remainder are probably Fed Libs that were voting for Ian Campbell. I actually think Shauna Sylvester might be the big winner on this one in terms of voter support.
I think that Shauna has actually had really interesting and like in-depth policy ideas. And I sort of challenged her on this a little bit. I was like, you know, what are you doing? You're like, why are you so interested in co-ops? Not very many people live in housing co-ops. Like, why are you talking about this so much? And she was really unapologetic. And she was like, I don't care. I'm going to be a policy wonk. I want to have deep discussions. And I actually was kind of impressed with her answer. So, yeah, we'll see if the voters actually resonate with it or whether my cynical thing about voters being overwhelmed by too much information is true.
Well, I think it was John Tory that said, the current mayor of Toronto, oddly enough, that an election is no time to discuss serious policy.
Kim Campbell.
Oh, okay. John Tory was running her campaign at the time, yes. But, like, it's almost... In fact, it probably is true. There's a ton of information that are in Shauna's policy planks that I don't think are accessible to the average voter. And I think that there has to be some kind of heuristic way for people to parse that information.
Well, I posted this on the Slack channel for our Patreon supporters. And I think one of the things that I sort of really think is that your average municipal voter, your average consistent municipal voter, actually has, you know, a friend or two that they reach out to every election to say, hey, okay, you know, I've heard all these things. You're a little more tuned in than I am. What's the deal? You know, and I have, you know, a bunch of friends that reach out to me. I'm sure most of the people in this room have friends that reach out to them. And so I actually kind of think that being policy deep in a municipal election can really work because the people that are policy deep have friends that look to them for what to do.
Well, like we teased earlier, we have two polls out, one from Main Street and one from Research Co., that kind of tell different stories about where Shauna might be. Main Street pegs Shauna at 4.5% with the undecideds at 40. Kennedy was at the highest at 14. And someone else is getting 10%. So maybe people are hoping Barack Obama enters the race.
But let's not forget about Maya Richards.
Yeah, Maya Richards got 1.1% of the vote. No one knows who she is.
Yeah. Oh, actually, who is Maya Richards?
Actually, Jen knows who.
Well, actually, I have to give props to Bob Mackin, a freelance Vancouver journalist who posts on thebreaker.news. He's the one who first broke this story. And I thought it was just so hilarious that I had to do my own version late today. And so Maya Richards is actually a 19-month-old toddler. Her mom made a funny Facebook post about how Maya was the youngest mayoral candidate, and it's very funny. Her slogan is "It's time for a change," and her other slogan is "Let's fix nap time," which is like a riff on Hector Bremner's "Let's fix housing." It was a very funny Facebook post. It went viral, and so I guess Main Street picked up on this. They actually have an explanation for this. Bob was kind of making fun of them for this, but their explanation is that pollsters apparently often put like a fake name in polls just to see if people are paying attention and to kind of figure out like whether people will just like sort of pick any button. And so this was apparently just part of their polling.
So I've signed up for a number of like online forums, and I used to do a lot more of them. But when Mario was with Insights West, I think right when he was finishing there, I did one of their polls where there was a list of potential mayoral candidates. And this is the one where I think Kennedy did so well that he decided to enter the race, as in he told us he did.
Was there a fake name?
There wasn't a fake name. It's so much better.
It was a very, very well-known name to that pollster.
To us. It was Mario put himself in the poll.
Oh, okay. So this is true. Pollsters do this. I didn't know how this worked, but
they don't tend to release that.
But the reason that he had to put Maya in the list is because Bob had earlier posted an entire audio of the poll on his website, and so the pollster for Main Street said to me, like, we had to put her in the list. Although I think he could have put a little bit of explanation because people were trying to find out who Maya is. She had no online presence. It was this mystery. She's
at least an asterisk.
Ian That's Campbell right. was just polled by Research Co. but didn't come out in the data. And
like, it is interesting that they are polling someone who, like, I don't know what the actual status of her joke campaign is, but, like, if she has a slogan, then there is, like, some entity, and that person becomes more of a rhinoceros party for parked votes who are discontent with the actual system.
Maybe Maya should run. Maybe something interesting would happen.
Think you have to be 19.
18?
18?
Yeah, 18. So the Research Co. that Mario Canseco put out had some really interesting stuff for the mayoral election. What it found was 23% would vote for Kennedy, which was a plus 13 over the people that said they were not voting for him. Shauna Sylvester was at 19%, very respectable for where she was in the previous poll, with a plus 11, meaning that she, you know, 7% of people said they wouldn't vote for her, and whatever percent said they would, net 11. Ken Sim was at 18% with a net plus 4% rating, meaning that a lot of people wouldn't vote for him, but, you know, a lot of people would. And then the next really interesting one to me was Hector Bremner comes in at 15% support, not all that different from Ken Sim, but Hector Bremner's at minus 2%, meaning more people told the pollster they didn't like him than did.
Even better to me was Wei Young, who 10% said they had a strong, you know, positive opinion of her, but 26% said they had a negative opinion of her. So most people who meet Wei Young don't like her.
This is not like a laughing matter, though, because like a person can still get elected with 15 or 10% of the vote if the rest of the vote is split.
As long as you carry Pennsylvania.
Yeah, but
well, and it turns out in Ontario, you don't have to have a net positive to win.
Oh, dear.
So these numbers are really interesting, and they paint what I think ends up being a bit of a four-horse race between Kennedy, Shauna, Ken Sim, and Hector Bremner, with sort of some also-rans that may be able to pull up at some point, but are sort of running pretty far back. And it's going to be really interesting to see, at least, you know, speaking to what you were saying there, Jen, with the drop of Ian Campbell, we're now looking at least four mayoral candidates instead of, you know, 14, I think at one point we were all tracking.
I mean, there's still going to be that many names on the ballot.
True.
10 to 14.
And when it comes to voting for council candidates, I mean, that's when it gets really crazy. Like, that's when you have all the independents, the full ANPA slate. That's going to be difficult for voters.
Well, and that's where Main Street's poll was really unhelpful, because they polled only the parties that were running mayoral candidates. I think to try to tell if your support for a mayor was more about party or person, and it seemed like people had more favorable opinions or recognition, at least for parties, than some of the candidates so far.
But
Mario's poll found the opposite. It found that a lot of people were considering independence. So
Mario's poll also included all of the parties that are running for council.
The thing that bothers me most about these, the polling of council, and this is something we get asked a lot about, like polling of councilors, whether who's doing well, who might have a chance, especially with how many candidates there are, is it's really impossible to know. You know, Mario found that 46% of people said they were going to vote for Green candidates. Well, the Greens are only running, what, four council candidates? And maybe that 46% just meant Adrian Carr.
But those people from the last election made her the top vote-getting councilor.
No, absolutely. But those people are also going to vote for a bunch of other people on their ballot. And so we have no idea what that result ends up being.
And 39% of people said they'd vote for independents, which might just be they like the idea of independents, but they don't know any. And so,
or there's one independent pulling all the votes.
Or it's split evenly between the well-known independents and the others.
I think the thing with polling of council, and this is something that I'm going to really keep talking about as we go forward, is really vote for councilors you like, because there's no way to really know what councilors are likely to top the ballot other than potentially councilors that topped the ballot last time.
I am, like, the thing that I would be interested in when looking at these polls is what the name recognition is for some of these candidates, because if the name recognition is low and they have the ability to get information about their candidate out to people, then their pool of accessible voters is also going to grow. And then also this sort of accessibility number is interesting because it shows which candidates have win potential.
So we were talking earlier about Ian Campbell dropping out of the race yesterday, and it was really awkward for us because, like I said, Ian and I were in cars on our way out to Abbotsford to watch a really amazing concert. But most of the people that actually cover municipal politics were up in Whistler, meaning no one was in Vancouver to actually report on this. So what were you doing up in Whistler?
Well, we were at the UBCM, as I said, a thrilling gathering of all of the elected representatives from across BC. I love the UBCM. It's where all of the councillors and mayors from a lot of the smaller communities come, and the big communities, the big city mayors are there too. And they get to basically grill the province, like the cabinet ministers at various sessions, and they get to learn about interesting things like, I don't know, like a new housing program that BC Housing is running, and just like really nerdy kind of council-y things. And the province always tries to make a big splash by making announcements, although this year they've sort of been re-announcing a lot of things, so it hasn't been that exciting.
So there were a number of stories coming out of this, and we talked about one in advance from Justin McElroy of, like, the things to watch.
That's the trampoline parks, right? Well, the most important motion at the UBC.
Oh, yeah, they need to ban those. They're
they need
death
to regulate traps. Trampoline parks, yeah.
It's the most fun danger that I have ever experienced.
But aside from trampolines, what was your takeaway of, like, what were the controversies or, like, heated discussions?
Well, I think one of the really interesting things that was happening was there was a lot of talk about cannabis. A colleague of mine, David Ball, he attended a session that was about, it was actually about reconciliation with First Nations, but one of the topics that came up was that First Nations were asking for a portion of, like, the tax revenue from cannabis. So that was interesting. I went to a housing one, of course, because I'm obsessed with housing. I learned all about BC Housing's new Housing Hub program. Did you know that BC Housing is going to be building more housing for, like, middle-income people? BC Housing usually just builds, like, low-income housing. But they're sort of moving into the more, like, sort of like the city of Vancouver is trying to encourage more housing for, like, a range of incomes. Well, BC Housing is doing the same thing. So it's just a range of issues like that. I don't think that there's any one issue that's really come to the fore. There was also, like, a wildfire session. The province is trying to show that it's, you know, putting more money towards things that a lot of the councillors have in years past might have felt were being neglected. So wildfire funding for, like, wildfire prevention was that one of those. They did a daycare announcement. It's just sort of a raft of you know, the province trying to show that they're listening to the councillors.
The wildfire thing drives me absolutely insane because you could spend a lot less on fire prevention than we do on, like, firefighting and achieve a much better result that involves a lot less of the province burning, but that doesn't have anything to do with this, so we should...
I do have one other thing, though. So I've looked at the schedule for UBCM, and anybody that says that politicians are lazy, what time does UBCM start in the morning?
7:30 a.m.
And is that the breakfast call, or is that the first session?
It's a session. No, it's a really nerdy session. Like, they go and do, like, breakout groups and stuff. If you go to UBCM, like, you have respect for these councillors and mayors. They travel from far away. I think that they are having fun, but it's very nerdy fun, and they're really, like, in these sessions. And like I said, what I like about it is they get to come up to the microphone and they basically get to kind of grill, like, cabinet ministers on really important issues to their communities. And you hear a lot of interesting things. Like, for instance, one of the regional directors from the Caribou was talking to Doug Donaldson, the Ministry of... it's such a long ministry. Basically, the ministry that's responsible for wildfires. She was saying that, you know, there's still a road that's washed out in my community, and the school bus still has to do this huge detour. So these kindergarten kids are doing this huge detour around, and I really need this fixed. So it's just these really nitty-gritty things that they can kind of come and say, like, look, you're in Victoria, I get it, but I'm over here and I need this fixed. And they, I think they get action sometimes.
I also get the sense it's a very equal playing field, whereas, like, typically I could see the province caring about the mayors in Vancouver, Surrey, Kelowna maybe. But here you could have, you know, Fort St. John right after Victoria, right after Comox.
It's fantastic. It's a delegated convention, so everyone gets to bring their own ideas and their own policies, and all the people who are involved in municipal government get to vote in their, you know...
That's right. Anybody can make a resolution, and they do.
Well, from all the municipalities in the province to one particular one, this is a segment that we are going to call the Delta in Delta, because there is a change that is going to come in Delta, and change, of course, is expressed in mathematical nomenclature as a delta.
Isn't it more a musical chairs?
I mean, positions will change.
It all comes down to whether they can achieve the result they're seeking. So there's this party Achieving for Delta, and that's my terrible pun of the night.
Also, what a great name, Achieving for Delta.
I mean, we've beaten to death.
Okay, I'll stop making fun of
Pun. That is the only name that you have liked.
No, I don't like this name. That was me mocking it. Sorry, I don't know if that came across clearly.
So Lois Jackson's the current mayor of Delta.
And has been mayor since I was 14 years old.
And she'd announced that that's long enough, because you're not 14 anymore.
Last time we checked.
She's been mayor for 19 years.
Yeah. I was going to say Aqua had just come out. Yes. You weren't even 14 then.
No.
But Lois Jackson was retiring. It seemed like a good idea. And George Harvey, the city manager, was moving in to run for mayor.
Which is weird, by the way. That doesn't happen often. So George Harvey, the city manager, is running for mayor. He's got his own slate together. Once again, it's one of those one-party cities where only one party is running. And now Lois Jackson is running for council on his slate.
Continuity of government.
So the city manager is running for mayor, and the mayor is running for councilor, and they're all working together.
So on a lot of small nonprofits, or even big ones, you might have a past president role. And I guess this could maybe be that if your executive director was then going to be president and then your president became past president. And it's, yeah, musical chairs is a good way to look at it.
As the executive director of a nonprofit, would you call that good governance?
Well, continuity can be important.
It's also
it actually can be.
That's true.
Like,
no,
it is
right.
Written into the Societies Act that the past president position exists in the sample constitution.
So Delta continues to be very weird, is what I would put it as.
But you know how some municipalities where there's this question of like, oh, is the city staff, are they in charge, like rather than city council? Like, is that what's happening here, do you think?
Well, Lois Jackson's been mayor for, you know, going on nearly 20 years. And so she would have been able to essentially handpick the city manager and...
And kind of mold them.
They've worked closely together for many years. So. Yeah. So it's a weird one, but it's one that you can sort of understand when you look at the personalities at play. But it is still a question of governance, I would think.
Did you know that Lois Jackson has a tattoo?
What's her tattoo?
I don't know.
Please tell
me
it's like AC/DC.
I just know that she has one.
Either that or a Delta.
Oh, now we need a new like survey of Vancouver mayors and past mayors. How many have tattoos?
Let's get Justin McElroy on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Matthew, you really wanted to jump into this one, and none of us wanted to, so you get to lead off.
All right. So there has been a very exciting ruling that has happened respecting the Toronto City Council changes implemented by the Doug Ford government in Ontario. We're not going to spend too much time on this, but it is very, very weird that based on how the ruling is constructed and the right to effective and meaningful representation, which is found in the Charter, the Ontario Supreme Court has come very, very close to recognizing a constitutional right to wards.
So to back up just one second, as I think we've talked about on this podcast, I've talked about on Politico's, Doug Ford decided overnight, it seems like, but this had probably been percolating in his head for a while, that Toronto City Council's too big. And the perfect time to do something about that is midway through their election, because their election is on October 22nd, 2 days after ours. And so they passed a bill, rushed it through the... Parliament?
What is really?
It's the provincial parliament.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's the provincial
Ontario
parliament.
Provincial parliament.
Yeah.
And
OPP.
Reduced it from, what was it, 44 to 27?
47 to 25.
Cut it almost in half. And everyone was like, you can do that? And
it turns out they can't.
Well, so a number of people sued saying this violates our freedom of expression because we can't express ourselves through our vote and it violates our right to effective representation.
It's a democratic right under Section 2.
Yeah, so the judge here looks at this thing and hears from these concerned citizens who make a strong case. They bring in experts. They talk about, look, this will double the size of each councillor's ward, so they have to represent so many more people, and that makes it much harder to do their job. And the judge ultimately comes down on two cases. He basically says, this violates the freedom of expression. He talks a little bit about the like candidate's ability to door knock, like because when they were door knocking.
He says candidates have a right to know what the rules of the game are when they apply to run. If you apply to run for election and you put your job on hold, you take a leave of absence, and the rules are in place, the rules shouldn't change mid-game. I have a bunch of quotes from the ruling here, but essentially they all boil down to, you can't change the rules halfway through the game, you know? You can't turn to the Canucks halfway through the 2011 Stanley Cup Finals and say that, you know, a goalie can now start body-checking players, except that that's what happened.
But moreover, I think what is, like, salient about this is that the judge found that 111,000 people is an impossible amount of people for a municipal councillor to represent effectively at their city council level, at least in Toronto.
And Jen, you looked actually at these numbers recently here in BC.
Yes, the Toronto Star made me do a survey of several large municipalities, large and small ones in BC, and it was an interesting exercise. I had to look at like Vancouver and Surrey and Coquitlam and New Westminster and some other ones. And what I realized was like, okay, so the sort of average for like large cities like Vancouver and Surrey is about 66,000 people to one councillor. But when you get to New West and Port Coquitlam, those were the two I was looking at, it gets lower. And I was kind of wondering, oh, maybe they do have too many councillors there. I don't know. Because it gets to be like one councillor for like every 7,000 people. So it was actually kind of an interesting exercise in looking at representation and thinking about what would be effective representation.
So Matthew, you've argued this ward case. But I would note that at no point in the judge's ruling do they talk about geography in terms of space. They only speak about population per councillor. Vancouver has about 60,000 people per councillor.
Well, yeah, and I think that point is well taken. It's just that the way that this particular ruling was written, it didn't really contemplate an at-large system, and so I don't think it
precluded one in any stretch, though. I don't think it ever dealt with the idea of councillors per ward or anything of that nature.
It did say that there was a impossibility of representing twice as many people, like 111,000 people, with one councillor. And so it kind of intrinsically illustrates that there is some kind of scale beyond which effective and meaningful representation is impossible.
The sense I got reading the ruling, and I think we were talking about this earlier, Jen, and maybe you can follow up, was that the judge was just, in a way, really annoyed at the government. He, at one point, talks about a bunch of hypothetical questions about making a reasonable case for this that the government could have answered. And the next, you know, he poses all these hypothetical questions that the government should have presented on, and he said, what is their answer? Just a paragraph? Crickets. He just wrote.
I really enjoy that his response to a complaint was, crickets. Chirp, chirp.
So the judge just seemed annoyed both that the government decided to do this so fast and treated the judiciary as almost like an afterthought and just presented garbage arguments that he was like, no, you have to try. If you want me to rule in your favor, present me something I can work with.
And the government said, no, we don't. No, 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 no.
Because and invoked the notwithstanding clause.
So the notwithstanding clause, Section 33 of the Constitution Act,
They haven't invoked it
yet.
Well,
threatened to.
So there's a threat to invoke the notwithstanding clause. The legislation may arrive when they recall the legislature. But
in the meantime, though, this is really having an impact on the Toronto election. Like, there is a bunch of city councillors who haven't been able to register to be a candidate. Like, they're left in limbo, and their election is on October 22nd. Like, it's really having an impact there, this whole uncertainty of what's going on. So we'll have to see what happens.
We are now joined by Jens von Bergman.
Hello, thanks for having me on.
So Jens, we want to talk to you in this half, and Jen, I think you have some insights that would be helpful as well from covering these issues about data journalism, and then we'll get into Airbnb specifically. People probably who are at all involved in hashtag Van Pauly Twitter stuff will have probably seen your graphs and your charts. What is it you do?
I do random stuff.
Big questions first.
I do random things. So I do a whole range of things. Some of them involve me actually earning money. And some of them involve me just doodling along. And that's probably what most people know about.
So your background's in data analysis, visualization. What is it that gets you into doing that kind of work? Like, why do you make graphs charting how many people rent in this city versus others, and how much people earn.
This is like the reprise of our very popular segment, Charts on a Podcast. But
well, sort of if you look at data and try to understand things through data, there's this natural cycle, kind of how we go from data to visualizing, to analyze, to data again, to manipulation, to visualize. It's kind of, it goes round and round, and often as a byproduct, I have these like tons of graphs, and whenever I see something that is, I think, of marginal interest to people, I sometimes just post it, or maybe if it's something that requires a little more depth, I might like spin it off into a blog post. But it's typically stuff that sort of falls off the side of my day job, maybe, that kind of ends up through that.
So you're always posting these demographic data shifts or trends when it comes to Airbnb rentals and things like that, which we're going to get into. But my question is actually for Jen here, is when you guys in the media are looking for information and whatnot, when it comes to, you know, Jens's stuff or any of the other stuff that pops up on Twitter, how helpful is that in your role? Like, do you oftentimes take a look at, you know, these graphical data presentations and sort of use them or use them to inform your narrative?
Yeah, I'm not talented enough to be a data journalist. Like, I've tried, and I just don't have the skill. So people like Jens are really important. It's really important that the data I'm getting is sort of, like, nonpartisan, and Jens kind of tries to map his blogs with what's happening in the news. And usually what happens with Jens, when I call Jens, is that I'm desperate for a story, and Jens tweets something, and I go, oh, that's really interesting. So that's usually how I come to Jens, because he's sort of like times his blog posts with the news. His most recent data project with Airbnb was very, very useful, though. I think he provided something that nobody else that I knew of was providing at the time. So that was extremely useful, and we were able to kind of track that. And I was able to write a couple stories, actually, based on what was going on over that very special period when the great deletion of data was happening. So that was super interesting.
Well, the time has come, actually, for the Vancouver crackdown on crumpets and turndowns. The Airbnb enforcement has kicked into high gear, or, you know, to some extent.
Or it started.
It started. It is kicked into a gear, as opposed to just sort of, like, leaving the system live for the summer tourism season.
And so the big question was, with all of the new initiatives Vancouver was taking, will these work? Will this free up new rental spaces? And you have looked at some of this, and what have you roughly found at the big scale?
Well, so Airbnb is actually, it's a pretty long story. I'm really new to this whole thing. So some people have been at this way longer. I think sort of the first one was maybe Karin Sawatsky, who's wrote a master's thesis on it, has been doing. And here we have Ulrike, who's been at this for a long time, sort of on a personal level. But it's something that I got interested in as new, and the city has been on this for a long time too. So, right, so this process of these regulations that now went into place, it's been an over 2-year-long process for the city, from asking staff to look into this, to negotiating with Airbnb, to implementing these things and getting things done in April, to now enforcement kicking in. And I got really interested in whenever there's a drastic change happening, usually interesting stuff happens. So my interest is, of course, through Airbnb. It's about housing things in general. But it's also about sort of the stories on the side that maybe not many people care about, like what will that do to Airbnb rates? What will that do to just overall rentals? People care about that, of course.
So I am curious, what in general has been the impact of Airbnb so far on the accessibility and the availability of housing units in Vancouver?
So to give really definite answers is very hard on this, right? So it's a very complex problem. So one thing that we have is we've seen over Airbnb a growth in listings over time. And the impact right now, so we have about, at this point, after the crackdown, maybe 4,000 listings, plus or minus a couple of hundred, that are on Airbnb. It used to go up to about maybe 6,000. Some of those listings don't necessarily take off rental units off the market. It's just people on vacation that rent out their home while they're gone. And some of those are just suites or maybe condos or houses that used to be long-term rentals that got turned into Airbnb.
So over the last month, you've been watching and tracking Airbnb listings and seeing what happens. My understanding is a bunch went dark and a bunch switched over to be 30-day minimums. You know, to book the Airbnb, you would have to book it for 30 days because that voids the rules. How many units stopped being available?
Right. So there's a bit of confusion there. So the numbers that were cited as going like short-term listings that went offline, that number that captures both of those categories, right? So they can go offline in two ways. The listing can disappear altogether from Airbnb, or the listing can switch over to 30 days or more. So away from my computer, I'd have to think. It's about 20% of the list, like the total listings dropped by about 20%. And then out of those that were probably another 1,000 or so, so another quarter, switched over to 30 days or longer.
And the city considers that a success. They consider that long-term rental. So it's an interesting question of, the city really is going to be playing a game of whack-a-mole. Like that question that you raised, Jens, with me, you told me that you're like, oh, well, some of them are saying that they're in Burnaby, but I can see clearly that they're in Vancouver. And when I asked the city, Catherine Holm, the director of licensing, she was sort of like, oh, I'm going to have talk to Airbnb about that. And just people are going to be kind of trying to skirt the rules. So it's going to be interesting to see just how far people will go to kind of try to evade the system. Because I think a lot of people think they have a real right to Airbnb, and they're really quite shocked that they can't anymore.
Right. So I think overall, I mean, most of the listings that weren't compliant, that obviously weren't compliant, now are compliant. There are still many listings that are not compliant. So the ones that you just mentioned, people that somehow mentioned that, you know, they've put the city name as Burnaby, but placed them squarely within the city of Vancouver, like downtown. not just across the border. I mean, there's some
privacy. The Kennedy Stewart method.
Yeah,
but no, it's crazy that you can just do that, and yeah, that Airbnb doesn't.
Or write Vancouver, the name Vancouver, in a foreign language, right? So there are some ways, but there's only about 40 listings max that fall into that category. So, and this is something that'll get worked out sooner or later, I'm hoping. The bigger issue is that there are still operators that do have a valid license. So when I talk about compliance, I mean just people either have a valid license or are 30 days or longer. So that seems pretty much in place right now. But there are people that have a valid license but don't use it according to the way they're supposed to use it. So the city has already said they have about 300 instances now referred to enforcement. And what everybody, of course, is waiting for is how will that play out? Well, refer to enforcement, will fines be leveled? Will these things disappear from our listings? And that I'm not seeing at large scale right yet.
So to put this into some perspective, the city of Vancouver has been seeing between 2,000 and 3,000 new rental units, purpose-built rental units added per year. And we just saw, you're looking at me like I'm wrong. Is it lower? Is it like 1,700? All right, so like 1,700 new rental units per year over the last couple of years. And we just saw, you know, like 1,000 Airbnbs go dark. They may have been added to Craigslist. They may have been added for rental. That would be, you know, 6 or 8 months of new rental supply, wouldn't it?
Yeah, so if you look at the overall impact, I mean, everything has an impact, right? We've had the empty homes tax that has definitely, you know, brought units back in. We don't really know how many. So that's something that at some point we'll see when they redo the Ecotages study that looked at hydro electricity usage. So that's one part. Airbnb is another part. There are lots of moving pieces. Getting more rental online at the same time is really crucial if you try to rent in the city. We have a vacancy rate that is extremely low, very unhealthily low. We've had a candidate say they wanted to go up to, 5 to 7%, the candidate for mayor, which is a very ambitious goal. The city of Vancouver in recorded history of what CMHC records has never really gone about. I think the highest was 2.1%.
CMHC being the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation.
So even going to something like 3%, I think is extremely ambitious and won't work, I think, unless the other municipalities in the regions pull in the same direction. So if Burnaby tears down existing rental and City of Vancouver builds more, it's sort of a null-sum game there, right?
Jen, I wanted to touch on something that you mentioned about people feeling a right to do what they want with houses or condos or whatever that they own.
That's my property. Property rights. We got to protect those.
Or, on the other hand, is housing stock a public good? Is it like a utility that you have some kind of license in fee simple over?
Well, I think the really interesting thing that's been happening is that there has been this shift. It used to be that the property rights argument was really strong and was kind of the dominant force in politics, I think. And we're seeing just this kind of like disillusionment and anger that's pushing what I think have been these policies that would not have been popular in other periods, but like the empty homes tax, cracking down on Airbnb, and people seem to be fairly popular. So it is an interesting shift in just people's anger kind of overriding the kind of homeowner's argument that it's my right to do with the property.
So, Jens, we've talked about Airbnb and a little bit into broader rental housing and how we'll know when these things are working. We want to get into the microfiche project that you told us about beforehand, but before we move...
And you don't mean tiny fishes.
Well, we could talk about that too. But first, you've done so much work on data that I kind of just want to like pick your brain. Like, what are the other things that you've been watching? Because Airbnb has been such a big story in the last week, just with the rental regulations coming in. Like, what are the other things you're kind of watching in the data world when it comes to Vancouver? Or actually, one of the things you said to me beforehand was... You like dispelling myths from people. So people, you were telling me that when asked, do people in Toronto or Vancouver make more money? The answer surprises some people.
Right. So there's a number of things. I mean, things change fast. So if we go back to 2005, the answer to that question was pretty clear. In the city of Toronto, incomes were higher than the city of Vancouver. In 2011, it was getting a little more iffy. In 2016, it's very clearly that City of Vancouver has higher incomes than City of Toronto. Now, City of Vancouver or City of Toronto aren't always the best comparisons. If you look at the metro level, it's roughly even right now. But so there's a lot of things that the media catches onto and really latches onto. And there are other stories that's kind of like just don't get much coverage. Another one is we really care about affordability. So affordability metrics, there's a range of metrics of how we can measure affordability. One of them is, of course, we can look at the ratio of home prices to incomes. I don't think that's necessarily a very useful metric. Wealth plays such an important role nowadays. But it is still a valid metric that tells us something, and it does get a lot of press. There's a different metric that is also very important, which is how much of my income goes toward housing. And we can split that up for renter households and for owner households or overall. And there's, for example, a story that got a lot of play in Toronto because the ratio of the population that pays 30% or more of their income on housing or 50% or more of their income on housing, either renters or homeowners, it increased in Toronto. So that was a big story. Well, in Vancouver, that ratio decreased.
Really?
And there, yeah. Yes. So it is somewhat surprising. Yeah. There's distributional issues at play, right? So, there was no play of that at all.
Right.
And these are things that I find interesting, and it clearly shows to us that there are parts of the housing story that we're completely missing, that we do not understand. Like one metric is usually never enough to capture a whole story.
Sure.
But what are we missing, and we really don't know at this point.
That's a really good point. I think we'd like to switch into a bit of a Q&A now.
Yeah. Oh, the microfiche.
Oh, yeah. Do we want to do... I don't know if we have time for that.
Just a quick plug of it.
Yeah.
So we teased this already. This project you're working on, you have a volunteer project.
It's actually not me.
Oh, sorry.
I love
you
all.
Plug.
Abundant Housing Vancouver has a volunteer that's gone into the Vancouver Public Library and is pulling up microfiches. And for those that aren't aware, a microfiche is basically, I guess you could call it a very, very tiny overhead projector slide.
Yeah, I think so.
And they're digitizing Census Canada tracks for you. And is that being helpful?
Well, it's not really for me. I mean, it's Stu has been going out there and sort of his own idea because he was really interested in to see where neighborhoods come from and where are they going. Like, how do we get to the current situation? And he started by just going and looking up this really old census data back to the 40s and systematically recording data over time, like population, dwellings, some other census variables, And then they're doing the work to tie these together in a way that it's a time series that is comparable over time to see where different parts of Vancouver has gone. And some really interesting stories have come, like Shaughnessy has seen a decline in population. Of course, we know downtown has seen an explosion. But just to show how these different neighborhoods have grown over time, how the incomes have grown, and how we got to the current state of affairs. And I found that extremely interesting, and he's made that data available for anybody to play with.
Do you have one piece of interesting fact you've drawn out of that?
I think you'll have to bring him on. He's the authority on that. I'm really just an onlooker, and I'm fascinated by it.
Well, on that note, is there anyone here that has any questions for either us or either of our guests that we have here tonight? We're opening the floor for any questions that are available.
I mean, don't be shy. You don't have to ask them anything, but...
Well, in that case, I think we end every episode of the Canby Report with a very similar segment that we call the Vancouverada. We've been seeing some really neat Vancouveradas over the last little while with our mayoral candidate interviews, which I'd like to give another plug for. But tonight, our Vancouverada, courtesy of some of our Patreon subscribers, are the Streams of Vancouver, the underground, unseen Streams of Vancouver. Does anybody know about China Creek Park? I'm seeing a lot of nods, a hand in the air. Well, I mean, China Creek Park used to be a creek. Tolmie Creek out on the west side, right by West Point Grey, or right by the Point Grey Road. That used to be a creek. We have all of these creeks in Vancouver that are now underground, and there's a movement afoot to daylight them. And this is a movement that's been going for several years. And I think it really got its steam going when Still Creek had its first salmon run. And so Vancouver has all of these streams. I think there's something like 30 or 40 that literally exist underground, and we could daylight them. And efforts are afoot to do so.
We've talked before on one of our early Vancouveradas about Brewery Creek, and we talked in that one more about the breweries that are in this neighborhood. But I think we mentioned that it is named after the creek that goes underneath, maybe not this exact pub that we're in, but very close.
Actually, very, very close.
I don't know exactly where it goes, but through this area into False Creek and out to the ocean. But
beneath this pub or thereabouts, a creek ran which once saw daylight and may once again, flowing out, hosting spawning salmon. Like, these creeks are actually quite interesting because they are like former homes of aquaculture, of ecosystems that have been since buried in the name of development. And I think it kind of shows how the city is reconceptualizing its way of interacting with nature.
And what you can do is if you Google around, you can actually find maps of the old Streams of Vancouver. Just simply Google Streams of Vancouver. And we can post it up in the show notes. There's a number of maps that exist of where these streams used to be, and they're really quite fascinating.
And you'll be able to find those show notes at canbyreport.ca, where you will find our brand new shiny website that I spent a full day building, because it's not that that's how long it takes to make a website, it's that's how long it took me to make it perfect, at least to my own specifications. But I'm pretty proud of it. I also want to let Jen and Jens, because we had to invite all the Jens up on stage at one time, give a plug. Jen first, where can people find you and your work?
Okay, you can go to thestar.com, but don't stop there. This is very important. You have to add /Vancouver. So thestar.com/Vancouver or on Twitter at Jen St. Den.
And people can read 5 free articles per month and then they have to start paying, but they should start paying for media because it's how we all keep employed.
You know where we could in fact start paying for media? You could start paying for media at patreon.com/CanbyReport. Now, patreon.com/CanbyReport is the location of the Canby Report's Patreon page where you can donate money to this fine podcast, and you can gain access to things like our full-length mayoral interviews. Now, every one of our mayoral interviews has had some nugget of news, and the Ian Campbell one, I think, is going to be particularly interesting in retrospect.
Especially since it's only ever going to be available to Patreon subscribers, probably. But Jens, where can people find you?
Probably for some kind of deeper data stories at doodles.mountainmass.ca, or you can find me on Twitter occasionally at vb_Jens.
In 11 days, on the 22nd, nominations will close and the actual campaign will begin. It is exciting. The long, tough slog that we have been grinding through since early this year. So many episodes. So thank you so much for being with the Cambie Report, especially for those who have been there since the beginning.
A big shout out to the staff at the Dublin Gate for hosting us once again. We'll have one more live show before the election and then an election night party with details to be announced very soon once we've confirmed them.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time tonight. Feel free to grab us for a beer afterwards. For the Cambie Report tonight, I am Patrick Meehan.
I'm Matthew Naylor.
I'm Ian Bushfield.
I'm Jen St. Dennis.
And Jens von Berkman.
Good night, everyone.
And on that note, I think we're going to cycle into the next section, which means that what we're going to ask for is anybody running for election in the room. If you're running for any level of election in the room, please step forward. And we're going to ask you to come up here and give a 1-minute spiel about who you are and why you're running.
So I'm not going to start by telling you what I'm going to do. I'm going to show you what I've done, and I hope that that'll give you some information about me. But 20 years ago, I started by a couple of friends of mine when I was like 18, 19. We opened up an indoor skateboard park just like 2 blocks away down there. And it was world known and a pretty crazy place. But people from all over the world came, and the city and different folks noticed, including the fire department. Oh, shoot, I don't have that much time here. Anyways, we were able to get this place going, and folks from all over the world came, and it taught me about activism. I joined a community center, and we started a organization called the Skateboard Coalition, and we got 8 different skateboard parks built in Vancouver. Then I ran for park board in 2008, got elected. We did a bunch of amazing work, and now my name's Sarah Blythe, and I'm done, I guess, even though I didn't. But I've done a lot of stuff, and I'm willing to work really hard for you.
Hi, I'm Derek O'Keefe. I'm running with COPE for City Council. I'm a renter. I'm proud to be one of the founders of the Vancouver Tenants Union, which any renters here tonight should join, including the serving staff. Everyone should get involved in the Vancouver Tenants Union. Our election campaign at COPE is not just about getting progressive people elected. It's about building the social movements we need to save the city, to fight for a livable, inclusive city where more people can live, where more of us can afford to stay. My family cannot afford to stay in this city. I certainly can't afford to run for office, but I decided this year I couldn't afford not to run. I'm honored to be running with Gene Swanson and Ann Roberts on the COPE ticket. We know even if the three of us, best case scenario, get on there, we need to work with other progressives. So we're looking forward to building a new progressive coalition. It's going to be a totally different council, and we need to fight for a totally different city. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Oh. Hi, my name is John Yano, and I'm running as an independent for mayor of Vancouver. I'd like to acknowledge that we're on the unceded territory of the Coast Salish people, the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish people. I am running to support a rental vacancy rate of 5 to 7%. That would mean that there would be a moratorium on upzoning for market condos. I also am running to end blanket rezoning. I believe community consultation is essential. All of our communities need greater density, but I think individual candidates don't have the solution, and we can consult with communities to find the ways that work for them. Thank you very much.